Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum here at the Commonwealth Club. The Humanities Forum puts on about 30 events a year, and we have a list out in front. You can pick it up. I just thought I'd tell you a little bit about what's coming up. In August, as some of you may know, Commonwealth Club has a series that they do every August in order to, you know, put a theme to the month. It's the only time we do that. I think you can figure out why August is kind of a slow month otherwise. The theme this year is India. And the Humanities Forum is going to do two events on India, and we co-sponsor a third event. The first one is on August 1st, Monday, August 1st, 6 o'clock. Swami Beyondananda is going to speak. Some of you may have, someone's laughing, so they've obviously already seen him. Or maybe it's just the name, but this is a guy who has been imitating, Indian gurus and the jokiness of the way they approach things for about 30 years already. Very popular. He also is invited to speak to the gurus and their followers sometimes because he entertains even them. But in any case, we're starting up. His speech is called "Wake Up Laughing, Wise Up Loving," and so he'll be speaking August 1st. Slightly more serious, but not that much more serious. The next week, for Monday Night Philosophy, the next in the series is, those of you know who come often, we're now on the second Monday of every month, have been for about 6 months. And I'm going to be speaking on the philosophy of yoga and the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita is one of the major scriptures of Hinduism or Hindu religion, but it's also the major scripture of yoga. And it is a philosophical debate between Arjuna and Krishna. Arjuna is a warrior, and Krishna is a god, in case you haven't heard of him, or never heard George Harrison's song. That's usually how everybody heard about him, in my generation anyway. It's very interesting because a lot of people, of course, you know, go through all the different parts of yoga is in there in the conversation between them. But basically what the conversation is about is that Arjuna is a warrior, and he's going to do battle, and he's supposed to go into battle, and he doesn't really want to. The reason he doesn't want to is because his uncles are on the other side. So he's going to have to fight his own relatives. He's got to make up his mind about this. And Krishna tries to talk him into it on a large number of bases, a large number of arguments. And, of course, there's a digression all about yoga for one-third of it. But in the end, he doesn't convince Arjuna, in spite of the fact that Arjuna knows he's God. So, you know, he shows him what being God means. And then, of course, Arjuna does exactly what he said. No more questions. You just do what it says. In that case, it's very, very much like the book of Job in the Western tradition, in that there's a whole long discussion about all the evils of life and things that can go on and the best things and so on. And in the end, there's no answer, and God just says, look, I'm God, do it. So an interesting and bicultural thing. So we're going to discuss that. And then the Arts Member Forum on August 24th, Wednesday, has Bubal Tiwari, a Stanford professor, speaking about Bollywood Now. And we're co-sponsoring that for those who want to. And there'll be clips of the most popular Bollywood films and a discussion of them by the Stanford professor. So that's our August. And as I said, you can see all the other ones. And, of course, the club puts on about 400 events or 450 events a year. So we're only about 8% of them. Now, I'd like to welcome all the new members. We hope that you'll enjoy your membership. One thing that's slightly different about this, the Humanities Forum events, is that we try to dispense with the cards that you ask your questions on. The people usually have to write out their questions, and then a moderator will read them, because we know that people want to ask the questions directly. So I will bring a microphone around. The disadvantage, there's a couple, but the disadvantage is that the microphone has to be there so that the recording is clear. But I'll bring it around, and for the questions a little later on, we will go with the mic as we usually do. Now, since we're recording today's events, if anybody has anything that beeps or makes other noise, including myself and Denise, it's time to turn it off. And now I'll officially begin the program. Any questions before we begin? Great. It's great to see you here in number. Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our online and radio audiences and our audience here. We invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Denise Schickel. She's a Nietzsche fan. I'll tell you a little history. Were any of you heard my lectures here, I think 2001 to 2005? I gave about 20 lectures on philosophy. And I think some of the faces I've seen before at that time, that's was my introduction to the Commonwealth Club. I was invited to speak here. And Denise was someone that came to quite a few of those events. And when I restarted Monday Night Philosophy, when I moved back to San Francisco about 2 years ago, she said, well, it'd be really a lot of fun to talk about Nietzsche. Now, how many were at the lecture on Nietzsche last year? I know quite a few of you were, actually. There was a lecture last year on Nietzsche. But unfortunately, Denise was ill for that. That was for Denise's lecture. And so now we have her back to speak. And Denise's background is that she is right now writing her thesis, PhD thesis, in psychology, has been a Nietzsche fan for a long time and wants to talk about how Nietzsche relates to Maslow. And any other questions before we start? We'll have the question. We'll do the usual question and answer period as soon as Denise has finished giving the introduction. And if I have some questions afterwards to get it started, that's the usual. So let's get started. Thank you very much. Here's Denise.
Thank you for coming. I'm excited to see all these other Nietzsche fans, I presume, out here. How many people are Nietzsche fans? How many people are Nietzsche curious? Oh, great. What about Maslow? Any Maslow fans out here? Fabulous. Oh, a lot of Maslow fans. So if you want to add to what I say at the end, please do so. So my premise and my interest in talking about Nietzsche in this way is that when I read Nietzsche and I read his idea of self-overcoming and later read Maslow's idea of self-actualization, it seemed to me to be the same thing. Nietzsche's idea of self-overcoming or the overman comes out of his desire for us to use reason to govern our passions and to become potentially all that we can be. This correlates with Maslow's self-actualization theory. I will just give a quick overview of Maslow's hierarchy of values for those that are not already familiar with it. Maslow posited that humans have different needs and that when a lower need is satisfied, a higher need emerges. Our first need is a basic survival need. We need to be fed and we need to be basically fed and clothed. Then after we're not hungry anymore, the need for safety comes up and we need to be safe. So now I refer to my notes. After safety, which is represented by law and order, we need love and affiliation. So the need for belongingness comes up. After belongingness comes esteem. We want recognition and achievement in the world in which we live, in our culture. Then after all of these needs are satisfied, we come to the need for self-actualization, to become who we can be, to express our potentiality. Now, these five needs are generally found in all the textbooks about Maslow, but there's some theories about how he had talked later on about a self-transcendent need that came after self-actualization, whereas we would not only become everything that we could be as a sort of an ego expression, but that we would transcend ourselves and move out into the world and commit ourselves to an ideal higher than ourselves. Think of maybe somebody like Gandhi, for example. But here we're interested in how these ideas correlate with what Nietzsche had to say and why Nietzsche's idea of self-actualization, self-overcoming, could become, perhaps, a guide for our own spiritual path. Now, Nietzsche felt that self-overcoming was self-mastery through sublimation of our lower needs. By overcoming our passions and our desires so that the energy found in these passions and desires could be channeled to a higher goal. This is the ultimate form of life affirmation. the ability not to be governed by our desires, but nor to extirpate them and to weed them out, but to actually to use them, but to master and use them to promote our self-mastery. He believed that all people are motivated by the will to power, and that the will to power is the life force itself, that all of life manifests the will to power. Since we are embodied, our human reason, which is the most rational element of all of our passions, is what we can use to govern our other passions and bring out of chaos to organize ourselves and to channel ourselves to become our higher potentiality. Now, this whole idea of God being dead and Nietzsche's ideas, his idea of self-overcoming replaces the old foundations of Judeo-Christian morality. You don't need those Judeo-Christian morality statements and what he termed decadent cultural mores, because with the new rational governing of our passions, we can master ourselves. And this whole idea of self-overcoming is overcoming our passions and mastering ourselves. It is not power over others. Nietzsche felt that power over others was just another kind of weakness. That is really to be powerful is to be in control of yourself, not to control others by brute force or political means or economic means or anything like that. Nietzsche's goal, as I said, was not to eliminate the passions, but to spiritualize them. In this way, he can be looked at as a spiritual guide, to not have resentment and envy, but to overcome them and to be able to be everything that you can be, even if you can't be the greatest person. You can be better than you are, and you can admire people who are greater than you. Not necessarily, instead of envying them, you can admire them. So everyone, the great artistic people and the common person, all embodies the will to power. And the education system should be set up in a way that encourages people to develop themselves, whether they are average or they become artistic geniuses. So Nietzsche felt like what happened to him in his life, he had a lot of difficulties. He had a lot of sickness, as we know, and he overcame that to create works that are discussed all over the world. There's even a Journal of Nietzsche Studies that's published now that's current, that people write about Nietzsche, and all the books that have been written about Nietzsche. You can't talk about philosophy without talking about Nietzsche. And you can't talk about psychology, perhaps, without talking about Nietzsche. Freud himself felt that Nietzsche was a great psychologist. Nietzsche felt that Dostoevsky was a great psychologist. Both Nietzsche and Dostoevsky suffered tremendously, Dostoevsky in the camps, and Nietzsche throughout his life in sickness and loneliness. You know, Nietzsche's father died when he was 5 years old, and he was raised by his mother, his sister, and two maiden aunts. A young, sensitive, intelligent boy with no father figure to guide him and to confide in was part of his suffering. And when he was only 25 years old, he got a professorship at the university because he was so intelligent and he was so articulate. So I would like to read a quote from Nietzsche that he said when he talks about how his difficulties helped to form him as a person and his philosophy itself. He says, I have often asked myself whether I am not more heavily obligated to the hardest years of my life than to any others. And as for my long sickness, do I not owe it indescribably more than I owe to my health? I owe it a higher health, one which is made stronger by whatever does not kill it. I also owe my philosophy to it. Only great pain, that long, slow pain in which we are burned with green wood, as it were, pain which takes its time, only this forces us philosophers to descend into our ultimate depths and to put away all trust. I doubt that such pain makes us better, but I know that it makes us more profound. So here I will stop and open it up for discussion, and then I will have some statements later.
My first question, you mentioned something about educational system.
Yes.
And what did he have any program of education, or did he just make a comment about it? Do you know whether he had a program that he tried to change the educational system at all, or did he just write about it?
I don't know if he had a program or not. There was a there's been discussion about his views on democracy and how Nietzsche did not like democracy, in the sense that he felt that it would ground everyone down into pieces of sand, that it would make everyone the same. And what he thought, he was interested in pluralism. He was interested in everybody being an individual, and that the education system should be a structure that would provide an opportunity for everyone to be an individual and to express whoever they could be potentially, rather than everybody turning out the same.
That is a fascinating idea about democracy and aristocracy, and it goes down through the history of philosophy. Because we're just getting started with democracy. Some of you may have heard my lecture, Do We Really Believe in Democracy? And the reason that I ask that question all the time is because emotionally, almost nobody is interested in democracy. I gave that lecture right after the 2004 election, in which Bush once again won. And it was here in San Francisco, and I asked everybody, you know, how many people had a very strong emotional reaction to this election? And everybody had a strong emotional reaction. So then I asked, how many people were delighted? And there were about three in the audience that were delighted. And I asked, why were you delighted? They said, because I'm a Republican, and I always like it when the Republican wins. It was fairly that simple. So I asked the rest of the group, how many of you, you know, were less than delighted? Everybody sort of said, I was miserable, furious, so on and so forth. So I said, okay, so those are the two basic reactions. How many of you here at the end of the election said, well, my guy didn't win, but the majority will once more triumph, and I'm really happy about that? And that actually would be your emotional reaction if you believe in democracy, in the will of the majority. Now, obviously, almost nobody believes in the will of the majority. Almost nobody runs any institution that way. That's emotionally where we have to get to. I think it'll be at least 1,000 years. We could probably have the same conversation, and we'll still be saying, you know, we want things our way. We don't want it the way of the majority. And I think this is something for us to get to, that we recognize that there's a wide variety of opinions, and we have to say, okay, how much more persuasive do I have to be in order to move people's opinions? Because it's in being more persuasive that you're going to move anyone's opinion in a democracy. So no, I mention that because, in essence, in an aristocracy, people have looked back and said, well, there's where all of our noble ideas come from. And aristocrats who tried to live nobly and the peasants were never living nobly, but I think, as you pointed out, I mean, if you're just concerned with survival and the aristocrats are making sure that that's the only thing on your mind, You know, that's not where noble culture is going to come from, but it doesn't have to do with anything other than your economic situation and what you need to focus on. And, of course, if the aristocrats have set themselves up so that they have a lot of time on their hands, you know, 5% might pursue noble aims, and the other 95%, we know what they pursue. They're not any more noble than they're back down on Maslow's list, you know, right above the survival skills. So what's interesting in Nietzsche's reaction to this is, and most noble people's reaction to democracy is a negative one. But actually, democracy is, I predict anyway, once it sinks in, will make it the most congenial location for noble people to have their share of the culture. It's not going to be the majority share, but their share of the culture will be most easily accessed and lived and enjoyed when it's a democracy rather than an aristocracy, because nobody will bother you. A lot of noble people have had their heads chopped off in aristocracies. And the reason for that, of course, is that that is a power. As Denise said, that is a power that is most dangerous to the rulers. Anybody who has the will to power about themselves looks dangerous to someone who has the will to power about the whole population. So I find that a fascinating experience, you know, for those. So next question.
I'd like to know if Nietzsche had any system of self-transcendence, just like you said, in regard to Maslow.
I don't understand what you mean by system. You mean...
Well, in his philosophy of overcoming, did the top part of it, when you got to the end,
right,
like Maslow's?
Okay, well, let me answer, and then you tell me if that's what your question was, all right, and we'll work it out, all right? Maslow, as a psychologist, he was looking at man and thinking, all right, what is man? What is man? What does man do? What does man need? Man needs food. Man needs security. Man needs love. Man needs affiliation. Man needs recognition. And when one of the lower needs is satisfied, another one will emerge. Now, sometimes people's higher needs will emerge even when a lower one is not satisfied, because that's who they are. I think Nietzsche, instead of looking at man as analyzing him, he was looking at what ought man to be? What should man be? And he was always focused on the end, on self-transcendence, on creating a world without God in which man would become his potentiality and wouldn't need, you know, decadent moral values to be good, that he would see that behaving in a certain way, behaving in a virtuous way, was an end in itself. Overcoming resentment and envy was a value in itself, and he didn't need a religion to tell him to be that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think your idea is also technique. Is there a technique to to transcend? So like a meditation or anything like that?
I don't think so. I think it's just who he was.
Yeah.
Do you know? I think it's just he was so intelligent and so... Freud called him the most introspective person that's ever lived, you know, with the most penetrating insight. It's just who he was. And he, maybe it was because of his suffering, as I just read, because of his suffering, it drove him down into the depths. And he was very intelligent. And that's the way he used his mind. You know, he just was that.
This, you know? Okay.
Yes.
Let's go to the next question.
I think one of Nietzsche's ways into this idea of becoming the best person that you could be was from his background as a classicist. He especially admired the archaic Greeks. He did not admire Plato. He didn't admire Sophocles or Euripides. He didn't... Actually, I'm not quite sure if I remember about Sophocles. Please strike that. But he didn't admire Euripides. He admired Aeschylus. He liked people before they started really analyzing things too much. He loved just this full vision of life without really tying things down too precisely. And just this fullness. It wasn't all reason. It was everything, emotion. He also admired the Renaissance a lot. He admired Shakespeare. He loved his emotional intensity too. What was Maslow's? I mean, a lot of his, if I remember, at least according to what I remember from reading, a lot of his ideas about going up the hierarchy were kind of in reaction to Freud. that he was too concerned with just negative. You're healthy if you're not classified as sick, but what about the top 50%? I'm wondering if Maslow had a strong classical background, or if there were other paths that he also took into that idea of self-overcoming.
Yes, I think you're right about Nietzsche being interested in classics. He talked about that, about the classical traditional idea. About Maslow, I don't know. I suspect that there's always, ever since Freud, and Adler broke away from Freud. There's somebody shaking their head. Somebody else can answer this. There is, ever since Freud, there's always been a reaction to Freud. Yes, do you have something to add to that? Yes, good. We have a psychologist in the field.
just that I did have a reaction to what you just said about Freud, yes.
Oh, okay. What?
Anybody know what Maslow's background is in education, whether he favored classicism?
What brought him into his ideas about self-overcoming?
I'm not a Maslow scholar. I know Nietzsche better than Maslow. I don't know what brought him there. Yes.
Oh, okay, and my question is, if there is no eternity above man's will, then say if man overcome all his self-weakness, then where is the man going to go? Will he get lost, or he has still have any other will?
I'm not sure. Do you understand the question?
Yes, I do. Do you want me to take that one?
Well, you could reiterate it after.
Okay. The question is, if man gets all the way to self-actualization and transcends that, and he gets all the way to that, then is there anything left for him to do? Is there any will left? Is there anything to will?
So I think when Nietzsche talks about this will to power is this superabundance of life force in someone. And if someone achieves a high state of transcendence or self-actualization or whatever words we want to use, that abundance will overflow into the culture. So Nietzsche felt that if we all achieve self-transcendence, then we will transform the culture.
I mean, the next thing would make you transforming the culture, but I think your question goes to what is the purpose of the life once eternity or transcendence is reached? What is the purpose of life? A very, very interesting question. I've spent some time on that, actually. Mm-hmm. But I think instead of going into that topic now at length, I'd like to just say one thing about it. First of all, in order to get to that point, we need to have completely self-overcome everything. And I think you can make a standard for that would make it very clear we're not very close. And that is, you would have to think in your dreams exactly the way you think in your real life. That is, that the way you think is so consistent across all boundaries that all your desire, what you pursue in your personal life, daily life, is simply reflected exactly in your dreams. So for your mind to be that coherent, I mean, as obviously people talk about corruption, for example. They say power corrupts, in the will of power. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I have a slightly different take on that. I think power reveals corruption, and absolute power reveals all of your corruption. If you had a lot of power, and it shows what your dreams are when you have the power to enforce them. And if you are so a master of yourself that all your desires of your daily life are exactly the same desires with no consequences in your dream life, then you are the true master of yourself. And I can just about guess everybody would realize that we're a few steps away from there. So I don't think we're going to have to face this question very, very soon.
You mentioned Adler as breaking with Freud. Carl Gustav Jung had a momentous breakup with Freud. And Jung became a Nietzsche scholar.
Did he?
He was a Nietzsche scholar. He ran seminars in Zurich over 3 or 4 years just on Thus Spake Zarathustra.
Wow, that's great.
So do you know of any of Jung's
No, I didn't know that. I'll have to look that up. That's fascinating, especially when he's coming, you know, the archetypes. I would like to see what he had to say about that.
Right. He explores Nietzsche at great length.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I think the biggest challenge, one of the challenges that both Nietzsche and Maslow have to face is to somehow formulate specific guidelines for enhancing the spiritual power, controlling the passions, and test that out in concrete situations. Are you nourishing the other person to develop his potentialities? And are these potentialities positive? And they may vary from culture to culture. Ironically enough, and I'm sure you're aware of this, Nietzsche admired Ralph Waldo Emerson, and they were, even though they didn't know each other, he admired him because Emerson stressed the notion of self-reliance, which was connected, am I right, with Nietzsche's sense of power. But the biggest challenge is to direct that power along moral lines and look at Christianity and other traditions to see whether there's anything positive in them which will cause the people not to become weak, excessively humble, but very spiritually powerful. Am I right on that?
Yes.
Yeah.
So you're saying what you would like to see some kind of a structure established.
Yeah, a more specific structure which would vary and be flexible depending on the concrete situation one is encountered, whether with another human being or with a group of human beings. And I think that the test of his theory is how it's manifested in the concrete, in specific circumstances that people encounter.
So you think that people need a structure in which to learn how to channel their energies to the higher goals, because they really can't do it without that.
Yeah. Power in and of itself, strength of will, manifestation of potentiality is wonderful, but it has to take on specific qualities, test it out hypothetically in specific concrete situations. That's all. Makes sense?
Yes.
And I think, you know, Nietzsche probably did not address that because that wasn't his approach, because he basically said you either have it or you don't have it. And I don't think he was analyzing himself, but I don't think he spent much time trying to figure out how to raise other people that weren't there already.
Well, that's a problem, because he was so intelligent. You know, not everyone has his capabilities.
I would just say to that last comment that if you are conscious and you're living life consciously, in a philosophical sense, life itself presents you with these challenges. You don't have to have a system. You just be conscious and be there in life, and you will get those challenges which enable you to move up.
Right, and we all know the difference between right and wrong. You know, you can have a structure to keep you in place, or you can follow your conscience.
That's I've got a lot of variability.
Beyond good and evil.
I wondered if you'd comment on how much Nietzsche was influenced by Montaigne. In the book, How to Live, Nietzsche is described as the person who continued the thoughts of Montaigne. And do you have anything to say about that?
We had Timothy Hampton here to talk about Montaigne, so that was just great. No, he was here a couple of months ago. A lot of that had also to do with the flow of thoughts. I mean, to take it not so systematically, actually, but to be an observer and to revise your observations, to continually revise them, that was the basic idea behind it.
I guess I want to take advantage of the fact that you're here and ask you how Nietzsche went about stating or demonstrating or disclosing his views in his various works.
I can't hear you. I'm sorry.
How did Nietzsche go about demonstrating or stating or disclosing his views in his works? What was the form that took?
The literary history of how his ideas came out to everybody else, right?
Oh, Well, he wrote them down. Yeah.
Wrote them down. And how did they get published? You know what I mean?
Oh, well, his sister, right? A lot of his work, you know, he wrote sort of essays and he wrote aphorisms, short, little, brief, on this topic and this topic and this topic. He wrote a lot of different aphorisms, short little essay, short little paragraphs, and he wrote longer essays. His sister collected his works after he lost his mind, and did she publish them right away or waited till he died? She published a lot of his work.
He became famous before he died. He became famous before he died, but mostly it was word of mouth that was going around that there's this brilliant guy that was having a lot of interesting observations.
Because he was a teacher for several years, and so he was pretty well known in the intellectual circles.
Yeah. So it basically was another story where a family member, you know, had an interest in putting it together, even though the sister, you know, kind of skewed things. There's an interesting whole story there behind the sister eventually becoming interested in Adolf Hitler and that will to power and not probably understanding her brother's information, and that kind of moved things aside, the ideas aside, you know, to give it a different flavor. But it's a very strange story.
I guess I've just read some of the aphorisms. So didn't he read? He write some novels as well? And I'm just
Zarathustra could
very,
be.
You have a very rational approach of disclosing his concepts, and I wonder how you get to that point from these kind of disconnected quips that he seems to have put out. I mean, I'm wondering, you know, there must be other works as well. I know he didn't work with Socratic, you know, method or anything like that, but, you know, how do you get to this very rational philosophy from his work?
Well, I think the Genealogy of Morals is a pretty straightforward text, you know, as far as that goes. I just think that when Nietzsche was very intelligent in his capacity, he also wrote poems, you know, that you can access. His capacity to express himself came out in different ways. And it's just a result of his perceptions, his personal perceptions, and his verbal ability, and his education, his intelligence. I think it was very easy for him to express himself.
Yeah, he didn't, you know, I mean, from the literary history point of view, he didn't, you know, publish a book and then get famous and then publish another one, write another one, and so on. He was taking down notes all the time, writing essays all the time. And some of them were short, but some of them were long essays, and some of them were the whole books, Genealogy of Morals, The Will to Power, and Thus Spake Zarathustra as well. And that one is the only one that could maybe be considered fictional, but it's just a slightly fictional setting to say his ideas. So he didn't really write any novel stories or anything like that, although, as you said, he wrote poems. So he had essays. He had a lot of different forms that he used. But almost all, although some of those circulated among friends and so on, but almost none of those books that we now, this is what Nietzsche, none of those books were widely known at the time of his death. It was all put together afterwards. It was like, if there was a professor, it was like, you know, I don't know, Feynman had his own, you know, books and stuff like that, but Feynman was well known as a thinker and an eccentric and so on before, you know, his one or two of his books started to move, and he'd been a professor for a long time. And that might not be a good analogy, but it's something like that. And then somebody collecting, I mean, now you can get the letters of Feynman and all, I mean, all kinds of things that would never have been published by him. And I think it's a little bit more like that story.
You have a question. I hope you'll forgive a naive question. I had thought that Nietzsche believed that the man who had the will to power was better than the man who didn't have the will to power, and that the will to power entitled that man to invent his own morality, which was different than the morality of other people. Is that a popular misconception, or is that my own personal misconception?
No, I'm sure it's a popular misconception. Nietzsche was misinterpreted and misused by many people over the years. And I was reading an article about Nietzsche. Apparently somebody wrote their doctoral dissertation on Nietzsche, and they were talking about Well, there's the there's Nietzsche, and then there's the Italian Nietzsche and the French Nietzsche, and you wouldn't even recognize the French Nietzsche, you know. And it was it's amazing how many people study him, and more than any other philosopher I've ever read, and I haven't read them all, Nietzsche tells you exactly what he means. He's very direct in his approach. He's very intense. He speaks directly to you in a very personal manner, saying things like, "Dear reader, I know that such and such, you're thinking this," or, "Dear reader, I know when you follow me up to these heights, you're going to catch a cold because it's so cold and the air is so thin up here." Things like that, where most philosophers don't talk like that. He tells you exactly what he thinks, and I don't understand why he's always been so misinterpreted. It's amazing. You're right. It's true. But no, everybody has a will to power. Every living thing. That's what life is. It's like the life force. You have a little tiny bud and then a flower grows out of it. That's a manifestation of the will to power, the life force, the will to live. And in people, because we have reason, we can use our reason to channel that.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons for that is it's an easy misconception. That's I think one thing you can always count on is that easy misconceptions can overrun what the reality and be far more popular. If you study the history of religions, you can see that some interpreters' ideas are always far more popular than the original concepts because that interpreter is closer. It's just like in art, the person who popularized Victor Hugo's Les Miserables into a musical has far more people interested in the musical, and I think they did a very good popularization idea. I mean, taking the ideas and everything, but it doesn't have the depth because it can't, but it's more popular because it doesn't have the depth. And so I think you just have to look at the ideas, the history of ideas, and just recognize that that's always true. And whenever you find that some people are all chattering about somebody, go and read that one person and now who's chattering. You know, that's, I think,
exactly,
the crucial thing. Yeah.
Exactly. You always have to go to the source.
Can you tell me what tack? There must be thousands of theses about Nietzsche by students. Can you tell me what tack you're taking?
Oh.
What is your approach?
Oh, thesis? What he was talking about? My scholarly work?
It's not on the same topic.
No, I'm in psychology. I'm in industrial psychology. I can't remember when I first read him, but I fell in love. I just can't get over the way he speaks, what he has to say, and it's been over 20 years now. Whenever I feel depressed or if I need some comfort or something, I always go to Nietzsche. I find him, as I said earlier, I find him to be a sort of a spiritual guide. You know, I have these petty little problems, and I read Nietzsche, and I feel like I can overcome them. You know, and I can be more. You know, I can dig deeper. And because look what he went through. You know, it's kind of like that. And because he's so profound, it's so amazing. You just can't read him without feeling inspired. I find him endlessly inspiring. So I'm an amateur in the true sense of the word. It's total in love with what he has to say. Yes.
I continue to be interested in the top level of where he arrived. And I'm interested in the area of charity and compassion and love and those kind of things. How was he in relation to the people he was close to?
Oh, how was he in relation? How was his charitable behavior towards others? Good question.
Not transcendent. there are a lot of difficulties that he had. He had, he tried for some platonic relationships and then wanted to move past that. And a friend of his had the same idea, with the same woman, and that was, you know, a big problem in his life, and it came kind of a little later in his life. He stayed away from women quite a bit, so he's not a good place to go from that point of view of treating women. I have an analogy for describing how people look at the world, and I think Nietzsche fits this just perfectly. When I was trying to figure out why people think what they do and why the different philosophers and thinkers have done this, I realized that the reason that they have different perceptions is because of where they stand in the average personality. Now, if you take human personality, make a bell curve. Everybody knows what bell curves are, right? So you make a bell curve of the average personality. And as Nietzsche said, everybody has the will to power. Everybody's expressing it, but most people are caught up in mundane events and taking care of their personal details and stuff like that, and they don't spend any time or almost any time thinking about the main ideas in life. So one of the ironies that I found is that if you take that bell curve and you take the people at the low end, so let's say the psychotics, the people who are sociopaths, people who just look at the world and what do they say? They look at the human race and what do they say? They say everybody is way too good to be true. This is a dog-eat-dog world. Everybody's got to be much more vicious than they are, and they just don't know what they're doing, and I'm going to fleece them because of that. And that's the tail end of the... It's not a very big part of the population, but that part of the population looks at it that way. And then you've got this big bulk, and the average person, if you ask them, what is humanity like? What is humanity? What do they say? They say, pretty good, you know? All right, they're a lot like me, you know? They have foibles and stuff like that, and that, you know. But in general, they're pretty good-hearted, with a few weaknesses, and everything is just fine, more or less. And that's if you talk to an optimist, or if you talk to a pessimist, you kind of get the other half of that. But it's pretty much in that range. And then you come up to the top end of the bell curve, and let's just put Nietzsche in there, and let's put Plato in there, and let's put all the religious leaders, Buddha, and everybody in there. Invariably, what do they say about humanity? Definitely needs reform. Don't know what they're doing. They can't follow their own desires. They can't fulfill their own needs. They don't know. There's usually a very, very negative idea about humanity. And why? Because they're standing up here and they look back and the bulk of the people don't live their lives as effectively as they do. And some of them are inspired to say, well, all you need to do is do this and this and this and this and this and then you will be like me. So that's the structured program that somebody was asking for before. Nietzsche wasn't like that. Nietzsche just said, I'm me, I'm like this, and I'm in control of myself. And, you know, if anybody wants to peek over my shoulder and see what I'm thinking, go right ahead, because it might help me. Maybe it won't. That's a little bit more the way he felt about it. So that's the answer to your charitable question. He was not one of them that turned around and said, now, the interesting thing, and this is a good example of what I was saying before about how a popularizer of a religious idea completely takes over the idea. In Buddhism, Buddha's Eightfold Path is extremely austere. Desire is the source of all evil. I mean, that just wipes out human life, you know? And that's basically what, and all the different things that he says, and so on. For 300 years, nobody paid almost any attention to Buddha's thought, right? And then somebody came up with the brilliant idea of bodhisattvas. What are bodhisattvas? They're people who have gotten just to the edge of the transcendence that you were talking about. What are you going to do when you get to eternity, when you transcend everything and you merge with eternity, and then what do you do? Well, it's a very good question. We won't answer that one, but you're there. You're right on the edge. You're there for the whole purpose of life, and what does a bodhisattva do? A bodhisattva, out of compassion, to go to your question, out of compassion, a bodhisattva turns around and stands at that edge and doesn't go over the cliff and looks back and tries to bring everybody else up to that edge so they can all go over the cliff at the same time together. Now, the interesting thing about that is the bodhisattva has made a decision that the true goal of life is not to go over the cliff, but to help you. So it's a different conclusion psychologically and philosophically. And the other interesting thing about it is, and this is why it's so popular, it makes all those people the center of the universe. You are the goal of the universe in the bodhisattva's life. To get you to enlightenment is the goal for the bodhisattva. And that's why it's emotionally powerful. And that's why Buddhism became very popular. And there's a very similar transference of ideas that makes people the center in Christianity by its popularizer, Paul. And that's why it's powerful. It's powerful not because of some truth value, but because It appeals to our need to be the center of the universe.
Denise, back to your point or your comment about the wonderful spiritual elevation that can occur with Nietzsche. I've always thought, and my great professor Henry David Aiken used to talk about Nietzsche being a magnificent writer. Let us not forget that this is a person who wrote probably as well, if not better, than anyone who ever lived, that good. And as a psychologist, you're absolutely right. Sigmund Freud said he knew himself better than any man that ever lived or ever was likely to live.
Exactly.
Now, that's strong stuff.
Right.
The quality of the writing, and one of the reasons he loved Emerson, they translated Emerson for Nietzsche into German, but one of the reasons he loved him, he wrote beautifully the way Emerson wrote, and that is the elevating experience.
So there you have it. Good writing, penetrating psychological insight.
Well, I'm showing my ignorance here, but first of all, I would like to know what kind of illness did he have? And if you're saying he went out of his mind, what happened to him? I mean, what was his illness to begin with, and what made him so unhappy? Or was he physically ill, mentally ill? Did he drive himself crazy?
Yes, he was physically ill a lot in his life. He had problems with his stomach. He had colds. He had a lot of physical weaknesses. And as far as what made him go insane, there's a lot of discussion about that. And I don't know. Is there a definite reason?
No, there's still debate about it, but there's three basic theories. One that's been pushed a lot is, and it depends on whether you like Nietzsche or don't like Nietzsche as to which one you like to push. The ones people who don't like Nietzsche and his ideas say it was a psychological problem and it's influenced by his ideas. His ideas drove him insane, crazy. Now, I want to say one real simple thing about that. We always take our gods and try to look, when we elevate them, then we try to bring them down with the clay feet of one kind or another. What is the most popular picture of Einstein, for example? The one where he's sticking out his tongue and his hair is, going all over the place. Because it's like, well, he may have been smart, but he really looks ridiculous. I'm glad that I'm me instead of him. I mean, I think that's the emotional appeal of those things. And so in Nietzsche and in the case of Van Gogh, who's often mentioned the same thing, they're going crazy, they're cutting off their ear. It's a way that we can say. So when people dispassionately step back, there are three basic arguments about it. One is that he had syphilis, and that syphilis drives you crazy after a certain amount of time. There's a lot of evidence that that's not true. One of the main evidences is that he admitted that he had gonorrhea as a student, but he didn't say anything about syphilis. And if he admitted to gonorrhea, why wouldn't he have said he had syphilis? So that's one element to it. So there's a lot of people who think that the symptoms are similar, but the time frame of those symptoms are not accurate because he had some of his symptoms when he was 5 and 6 years old, so it probably didn't come from syphilis at that point. Another theory is that he was a manic depressive, that he was elated sometimes, and depressed at other times, and since he moved back and forth between those two things, when he was high, he did his work, and when he was low, he didn't, and that the end of his life, where he was confined, was he had a really big high for about 4 weeks, and then he was down until he died. So it might have been a severe form of that. And there's a lot of debate about it, because there's some symptoms that don't fit and some that do, So that's part of the debate. And then the other part of the debate is that his ideas being Dionysian, they just kind of drove him crazy in the end. Most people that don't like him like that idea. So there's no real answer to it.
We don't really know. We don't have any evidence. Now, he had headaches a lot. He talks about that when he's writing, that he can hardly see, that his headache is bothering him so bad, that the light is really bad, and that he's freezing. And he talks about that in his writing.
Yeah, and some say it's migraines, but then some people say, well, it didn't really fit the migraine thing. So
actually, I almost forgot my question, but one of it seems to me that Adler actually was talking about the functional purpose of different stages, which was something that hadn't been addressed too much before. And aside from that, one question I had earlier, talking about the death of Nietzsche's father, and did he, I was just imagining being raised by mom and, you know, if your dad was only here, you wouldn't be, and that over time that could develop into a kind of an antipathy towards religion. Maybe not.
Antipathy towards women. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
There's a beautiful quote, if I can find it in here, of what Nietzsche's father said. Nietzsche's father was a pastor. You know, he's a Lutheran pastor. And what he said when his son was born.
Go ahead. We've got a little bit of time. Go ahead and look. Go ahead and ask the question.
Yeah, keep looking.
I was just wondering the contrast between William Golding, Lord of the Flies, how he feels about human nature is so contrasted. That, how do you feel about that?
Do you know William Golding?
Yes, but I couldn't hear her question.
Yeah,
I think
Lord of the Flies. Yeah, the Lord of the Flies and his idea about human nature, you know, that being, you know, that only civilization sort of holds us together, and that if civilization is removed, we descend.
Well, then we come down to, you know, Hobbes and Rousseau.
Hobbes and Rousseau, yeah.
You know, is man in a state of grace in nature, like Rousseau says, or is, as Hobbes said, life is nasty, mean, brutish, and short? We can't prove it. You know, I can't answer that. I think that people, by their own tendencies, their own personality, they have an affinity for one philosophy or the other.
Time for one or two more questions. Okay.
I think I was getting the drift about his philosophy, the emotions versus the passion, the reason. Then you threw in that he was Dionysian. And one of my favorite essays was The Birth of Tragedy. And so now I'm a little bit confused again. Can you tell me how that is separate from the passions?
Well, I'd say that, you know, Nietzsche was definitely one who went with the flow of his emotions, but he was trying to master them. And he definitely was trying to, you know, I mean, for example, if you go to the whole idea of pursuit of pleasure, he didn't talk about it exactly like that, but he was for the pursuit of pleasure, but of a very noble kind. And I think that a lot of people looked at his way of writing and said it's Dionysian. It's not laid out and structured. Now, you have to remember, of course, that he was German. And, you know, it was after Kant and Hegel. And so, you know, almost anything is Dionysian after Kant and Hegel. So, and so Nietzsche, just writing clearly and straight, you know, sentences and little aphorisms, that all by itself, and not writing in a complicated way, is enough to appear too emotional, too direct from the heart, than and not so intellectual. It's a very, very interesting, actually, cultural thing, too, between Germany and America and other countries, because whatever your goal is, whatever your standard is for being smart, for being intelligent, for being, then all the people who are ambitious for that impression are going to copy that form, right? And so it's still hard to write a short, quick sentence in German because of Kant and Hegel, and Nietzsche is one of the few that have broken that barrier.
Right. I found it. I'd like to read this. This is what Nietzsche's father said when he was born. Oh, beatific moment. Oh, wonderful ceremony. Oh, ineffably sacrosanct work. Blessed art thou in the name of the Lord. With a heart deeply moved, I say, bring unto me my beloved child, that I may dedicate it to the Lord. My son, Frederick Wilhelm, thus shalt thou be named upon this earth, in memory of my royal benefactor, on whose birthday thou wert born. I mean, it's beautiful. That was his father, and he only had his father for 5 years.
And I think that's a very good place to end. So I'd like to thank our online and radio audiences and the audience here. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 108th year of enlightened discussion.